Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Apple Music, Coldplay and Taylor Swift. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
That was a really weird way of saying my name.
It was. Partly, I forgot
what my name was.
No, I haven't written "Hello, Chris" in the script.
So you don't. You forgot.
If it's not written down, I don't say it.
You don't know what my name
Sorry.
Is. Hello there.
Hi. As ever, and I'm sure no one would dispute this, we are going to take a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry stories of the last week.
This being a weekly...
Like we always do.
Music business podcast.
Yeah.
Undeniable.
Week.
That's
every
what it says
week.
On the webpage.
Mm.
It says it clearly. It's a weekly podcast. So welcome to our weekly podcast. And it has only been a week since the last edition. That's what you get from a weekly podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And what a week...
What a week.
What a week it's been.
It's a week when...
yeah, I mean, this is us trying to justify why this podcast even needs to be weekly. Because, boy, does a lot happen in 7 days in the music industry. I mean, people do maths, for starters.
There was quite a lot of maths.
There was quite a
it's
lot of maths.
It's getting to the end of the year, isn't it? It's that sort of time.
This week, yes, maths and lists of records and albums that were good.
Or not good, but...
Are you going to do one of them this year?
I'm going to do what I did last year.
What, not bother?
No, I did bother. I'm going to make a playlist.
And did you do a playlist?
Yeah.
There was a time when you used to really go gung-ho and you'd be like the best albums and then the best artists. And now it's
That's
like...
a lot of work at
now
time.
It's like, is 10 tracks that possibly...
It was 40 tracks.
Possibly came out in the last
40.
12 months.
And I checked my list. I haven't got 40, so I don't know what I'm going to do.
There must be some...
I'm frantically listening to stuff to try to find good stuff.
Must be some... shit J-pop you could fill
Currently,
it out with.
There's like 13 good songs this year, so I'm sure there were more. I'll find them. If not, I'll just pad it out.
Just pad it out?
Yeah.
Or maybe just go with 13. Why not? But yeah, so in addition to there being endless, needless lists of the best music of the last 12 months, stats come out at this time of year. Actually, most of the stats come at the start of the year, don't they?
Yeah, and then the middle of the year. I mean, stats come out all year round. I don't know why I'm saying this is the time for stats.
UK Music, they are an organisation based in the UK... Linked to music.
Yeah. For anyone outside the UK.
And they have brought out a book called Music by Numbers.
Yeah.
You might think that...
No, it's not a review of the current pop scene.
Or a sort of a thing for very young children to learn to play the piano with numbers on the keys or something like that.
Yeah. I've got one of those books.
No. It's basically UK Music's annual... because it happens every year, annual attempt to justify the value that the music industry brings to the UK economy.
Sure.
What is known by economists as the gross value added, a specific figure that nobody except 7 economists understands, but it means that the music industry gets to go around saying, oh, we contribute billions to the UK economy, and everyone takes it as read because an economist somewhere understood it.
Yes. Now, we always mock this number, as you might have noticed, but it does a very good job because what they do is they put this figure out every year, and then the whole rest of the year, politicians quote it back to them.
Yes.
Well, of course... the music industry contributes this much to the UK economy.
Because UK Music's main job is lobbying, is representing the music industry, where there is a consensus within the music industry amongst political types. And yeah, exactly that. So every year they do some maths and they say, oh, the music industry contributes X billion to the UK economy. And then from that point onwards, whenever politicians are talking about the music industry, they will always begin with, oh, we all know
yes.
that the UK music industry contributes blah, blah, blah to the economy, which is helpful when you're trying to persuade those politicians to do things that are friendly to the music industry.
Yes. And the good news this year is that everything's up, 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 up.
It's gone up.
It's been over half a billion up. I mean, the music industry's adding so much more to the UK economy in just the space of a year. It's amazing. It's up from 4.5 billion last year to 5.2 billion this year.
That's how well...
That's incredible. That's such a leap.
The music industry is doing now.
Oh, it sounds like you're going to put a caveat on that.
It has to be said. And to be fair, they do say this in their report, presumably based on the assumption that politicians don't read.
Yeah.
So politicians will only see the figure on the cover. They won't actually read the explanation. They have expanded the definition of the music industry. So there is more figures in this to help us get up to the 5.2 billion figure. So, for example, recording studios were not previously counted.
Mm.
Now they are. Record shops were not previously counted. Now they are. Lawyers and accountants were not previously counted. I mean, presumably that's half a billion just then.
I'm surprised it hasn't gone up more.
All those legal fees have been counted. And then perhaps most interestingly, and I think possibly of all of those most significantly, is the music instrument business, which we kind of forget about, don't we?
I've forgotten about it already. What was it?
The music instrument business. Yeah. The people who make pianos and violins and electric guitars.
What?
And
Music
production software, I suspect, is presumably thrown in there. And the
shops chuck it all in.
That sell all of that stuff. So it is true that, according to UK Music's maths, we never quite know where they get these figures from, but they reckon that the record industry and the publishers and the live sector, and let's not forget artists, songwriters, etc., because they are actually, of all of this, the biggest mm-hmm. group. You know, the people who moan a lot.
Oh.
They contribute by far the most, but all the different groups have gone up in the last 12 months, helping with the increase. But it has to be said that adding in those other categories is how we managed to take the leap from 4.5 billion to 5.2 billion.
It's good. Maybe, do you think next year they'll add some more stuff? What else could they add?
Well, music education isn't really in there.
Is there any money in that?
Well, the music schools, they all charge admission fees, don't
they?
Instrument teachers get paid.
Okay.
So we could add music education. I mean,
could add
radio.
Some Christmas crackers have little kind of whistle things in them. You could add the Christmas cracker market.
Well, now you've made it festive. What about greetings cards that play music?
Yeah.
We could have musical greetings cards in there.
Birthday cards that play music. That's a year-round thing.
And
this is great.
Do you remember there were...
Let's add 2 billion next year.
Musical toothbrushes at one point, weren't there?
Yeah.
Argos were selling musical toothbrushes that played music when you cleaned your teeth. So they should definitely go in there.
Throw that in. Throw the whole Argos business in.
The whole of Argos can go.
Just all of it.
Tesco and Sainsbury's sell music, don't they?
Yeah, throw them in.
All supermarkets.
I know, they're not making any money, are they?
They should go in. Amazon presumably is counted as part of music retail, but I mean, people only really go to Amazon to buy CDs and then they accidentally buy a car, don't they? So really everything that's sold on Amazon should be counted as part of the music industry. So we'll have the whole of Amazon in there as well. And churches, they play music.
Yeah. Someone from UK Music just totting up the collection plate, is it?
Yes.
Before it goes back
around.
To the vicar.
I mean, if you look, there are charts that show you the different strands of the entertainment industry and which are the biggest strands. Obviously, music actually, in the context of all the other entertainment sectors, is relatively small if you put it alongside film and TV. And then the biggest strand of the entertainment industry is gambling. It always comes top.
Mm.
Unless you count religion, because they don't normally. But if you say religion is a strand of the entertainment industry, and then that's the biggest. And I would say, well, what really is happening in churches? They're singing songs. So music could claim that. So I reckon religion should be included in the UK music figures.
So next year, UK music's figures are basically going to be, as we all know, music makes up 98% of the entire British economy.
So I look forward to those stats in a year's time.
I'm sure politicians would quote that back.
They almost certainly would, assuming
they're probably quoting it now.
Have any politicians in 12 months' time? We may have just given up on that whole part of society.
If maybe no one votes in the general election, what happens then if no one bothers to vote?
We just carry on regardless and stop talking about things, I think. So yes, maths happened this week, but that is not what we're here to talk about.
No, but we'll link to that story so you can look at all the numbers. There's lots of different numbers. You can look at all of the different numbers.
Or there's some charts. We didn't publish the charts.
No, but there are charts.
If you download the UK Music book, there are charts.
If you happen to like charts. If you like numbers and charts, the show notes for this episode, setlistpodcast.com, are the place to go.
Interestingly, not music charts. So not top tens like you might expect, but illustrations that you can go and look at in the
Money
UK
charts.
Music book. Yes.
No, because this week we are here to discuss Coldplay's vow to stop touring until they can make that touring not only environmentally sustainable, but beneficial to the environment, which is quite bold. They reckon it'll take 1 to 2 years. We'll get onto that. And Taylor Swift, who by this point in time has performed at the American Music Awards, but it was not a given that that would happen, so she claimed. But first, Apple Music has formally announced its much-anticipated move into B2B streaming, the big goldmine of the music streaming industry that people have not been capitalising on enough. And now, well, Spotify have got theirs, Apple Music's got its now. It's been testing it out in Harrods and Levi's stores. It's made it available to everyone. So all those shops now, bars, restaurants, cafes, who are all illegally streaming music, as we've discussed on this show before, will be able to buy an Apple Music subscription for much more than the £10 a month they think it's okay to pay at the moment.
But get the warm glow of knowing that they're doing it legally.
Yes, I think that the uphill struggle is is getting people to realise that they can't just have a streaming subscription and that'd be fine. If there's a special one, and Apple have got one, that's the news.
Yeah, you mentioned we have talked about this before on Setlist because it's come up at various points in the past. So, yes, Spotify have a stake in a business called Soundtrack Your Brand, which in essence is the same thing. It's allowing companies to have a Spotify subscription. They pay a premium. They pay more than just the usual £10, €10 a month. But as a result of that, that means they can legitimately play it in a bar or cafe or shop or whatever, which technically speaking, if you do that on a normal account, you're in breach of Spotify's terms and conditions. So Spotify I've been doing it for a while, and actually I think probably the last time we spoke about it on Setlist was when that company, Soundtrack Your Brand, put out a report in which they reckoned that because there were lots and lots of people currently using personal Spotify or Apple or whatever accounts in commercial premises when they should be using the premium ones, that there was a significant sum of money being lost by the music industry because they hadn't yet properly capitalised on B2B streaming.
Yeah, they reckoned $2.65 billion a year being lost, which, I mean, that's quite a lot of money.
It is an awful lot of money. And, I mean, there have been various commentators who have said when people have been discussing how are these streaming services ever going to go properly into profit? I mean, it's kind of looking that Spotify almost is there in terms of being an almost profitable business. Although,
yeah, it's a little bit, they had a bit of profit, but let's not jump the gun.
Well, also in both the quarters where they had a bit of profit, it turned out that they'd not hired as many people as they planned to. So if they hire all those people next year, they'll probably go back into loss. But some people have said, yeah, of all the things the streaming services do, this does seem like an obvious way to move, because you can charge, I mean, normally it's like three or four times more for the premium accounts. Now, obviously, you're sharing a significant chunk of that extra money with the music industry, which is why Soundtrack Your Brand last year was saying the music industry should really be getting behind this too, because it's not just the streaming services that will make more money. But it does sort of feel like that there is a huge opportunity there, and therefore both Spotify and Apple would be mad not to go after it. And Spotify, as we say, have been dabbling in this space for some time through Soundtrack Your Brand. And we kind of knew Apple was plotting something because late last year it emerged that they'd registered with the trademark registry in the US, Apple Music for Business.
Yes, which is a bit of a giveaway.
So we thought that, yeah, yes, clearly something is coming. And so, yeah, last week they formally announced that Apple Music for Business is now live as a service. Now, of course, as well as Spotify and Apple both offering this service, and in the US it's a more competitive market because both Pandora and Sirius, which are, of course, technically now the same business, also offer a B2B package. But there are other companies who their core business is offering music to retail. Over the years, those services have got more sophisticated. So I suppose back in the day, that the classic service was Muzak, wasn't it, where they were playing sort of library music where it was dirt cheap on royalties, but it sounded awful.
Yeah.
Or they got people to do terrible cover versions of songs so that although they had to pay some PRS money for the songs, they didn't have to pay any PPL money for the recordings. But then some of those retail audio companies then started to enhance their business and started licensing in commercially released recordings, because ultimately that's what most retailers want. And then they've subsequently moved into sort of the playlisting space. And some of those companies will then say to a brand, well, not only can you plug in to our platform and then take music from our service, which is all licensed, it's commercially released music, and have it playing through your sound system, but we'll put together a playlist specifically for your brand that we think will work well in your shops or your bars or your cafes or whatever. So that business has grown significantly over the years. So I suppose that means when Spotify, Apple, Pandora, Sirius move into their space, they are competing with those existing companies that just do sort of in-store type music. Although it has to be said, Apple is working with one of those companies on Apple Music for Business.
Yes, a company called Play Network, which was bragging that its new setup for Apple breaks new ground for business music services, does it?
Well, that's kind of them almost saying that their existing services aren't very good.
So, maybe they're not.
But they were sort of saying things like, ah, well, Apple Music have the best playlisters in the world, which again is a bit of a slur on their own playlisters, but they're sort of saying Apple have great music curators and access to great music. They were also saying that the Apple Music for Business app is completely built with businesses in mind, so it will do lots of things that business customers want that usual users wouldn't need, which you wouldn't get by just using the usual Apple Music app. And then they were also talking about the potential for marketing partnerships. So I think that's this idea that you can have your playlist playing through your sound system in your shops or your bars or whatever, run by Apple Music, but then you can then say to consumers, oh, if you like this music, you can listen to it at home on Apple Music by checking out our playlist. So there may be marketing benefits as well in using this service, in addition to getting these superbly curated playlists that Apple's going to bring to the table.
Yeah, on that side of things, apparently during the testing phase, Harrods was plugging Apple Music subscriptions on screens around the store. So maybe they get a bit of a discount on the subscription for doing that.
Yeah, so I suppose in addition to Harrods and Apple having a music service agreement, there is a marketing partnership going on there as well. So it is interesting to see now Apple are entering this market. I mean, on the Spotify side, they are investors in Soundtrack Your Brand, although it does sort of feel that although Spotify have been doing this for quite a while now, and at one time they were doing it in-house and now they do it through this other company, they've not been as prolific in that space as perhaps I would have expected them to be. And I don't know whether that is because, obviously, when you're playing music in store, you have to pay Spotify or Apple, whoever, the premium, so $30 instead of $10 or whatever the price point is. But in addition to that, because by playing the music over a public sound system, you are also exploiting the performing rights in the song separate to the stream that has come from Spotify. Not only do you need to have the premium subscription for Spotify, you also need a license for that public performance of the songs and recordings. And in most countries, you'll get that. So in the UK, from PRS and PPL, from the Collecting Society. And I know that quite a lot of these B2B streaming companies, rather than saying, oh, if you pay us £30 a month and play music through your sound system, you also get to pay some more money to PRS and PPL as an added benefit.
Yeah, I mean, you also there, you overcome the problem of business owners don't necessarily understand how the music business works. Maybe they don't listen to Setlist on a weekly basis because it does come out weekly, let's not forget. And so they're already, I mean, people are often confused by the fact that they have the radio on in their shop and then suddenly someone from PRS turns up and says, you owe us money. And they're like, what are you talking about? It's the radio. And then you've got PRS, PBL turning up, well, not less now, they've got a joint license. It's one person turning up and saying that. But still, that's a confusing thing for people already. And then you've got Apple turning up and saying, hey, you need to get a business license. And they're like, I'm already paying someone. If you could just have one person going and saying, hand over some money or we'll duff you up. As I'm sure, that's what they say.
That's the strap line.
Has anyone said duff you up since the 80s? I don't know.
I'm sure that's what Apple and Spotify salespeople are trained to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, the point is that the simpler you can make it, the better.
Yes.
And while in some countries they have managed to do deals with the Collecting Society so that they can do the sort of the one-stop license, that has not been arranged in every country. And so it might be one of the reasons why Spotify has gone a bit slower on this is that they're still trying to sort that out before they go big on it. But of course, now Apple are in the space, then if they're going to go big on this, they need to go big on it now, given you've now got Apple and Spotify, the two big players in premium streaming, now both active in the B2B side, on top of the fact that you do have the traditional retail music companies as well. And as I say, in the US, Pandora, Sirius also competing in this space. But although that Soundtrack Your Brand report that was published last year with, what was it, 2.65 billion, that might be an exaggeration because clearly they have an agenda. But I think it is definitely
do
true.
Do they? Oh, yeah.
That there is a significant opportunity in this space for both the streaming companies and the music industry. And on top of any new income that's coming in, there's also the added benefit that once shops and bars, etc., are using a Spotify and Apple to play music through their sound systems, that we get accurate reporting from those stores.
Yeah.
So an income stream that comes into the music industry through PRS, PPL, where traditionally we've never really known what to do with that money, and it often gets shared out in slightly ambiguous, imprecise ways. The minute it's all coming in through Spotify and Apple, we'll know exactly what's being played in all of these places, and we can start doing some accurate reporting and accurate distribution of the money. So there is both a financial benefit in terms of there should be, even if it's not quite as much money as Soundtrack Your Brand say, there should be a significant extra revenue stream from all of this. Plus, we actually know what to do with that money and we can make sure that the right labels, publishers, artists and songwriters are getting paid. So all in all, I think it's in everybody's interest to make this work and to capitalise on these opportunities. But as that happens in the year ahead, it'll be interesting to see who has the edge between Spotify and Apple as the big two players in the streaming space.
It's the next big battle in streaming, although I'm not sure the current battle in streaming has been won yet.
Well, we can have more than one battle.
Lots of battles. They're fighting on all fronts.
We can do with more than one battle at any one time.
Still to come, Taylor Swift being silenced by her former record label, or not, depending on who you ask. But now, Coldplay have said that they will not tour again until they can find a way to tour the world without damaging the environment. This despite the fact that they've just released a new album.
And despite the fact that they made this statement during an interview, having flown out to Jordan in order to launch that album.
Yes. It was possibly an own goal there, but I think they got away with it.
So, yes, this is one of the biggest bands in the world, openly commenting on a topic that has come up increasingly only really in the last 12 months. We're sort of the latest round of campaigning about the climate emergency, as it's now often referred to, and a lot of musicians coming forward and saying this is a cause that they passionately believe in and that they are supporting things like the Extinction Rebellion campaign. Some people are actually bringing this topic into their music making and they are encouraging their fans to be more environmentally friendly. And I suppose
as the whole Music Declares organisation that's brought a lot of this together
here in the UK, and that's not just artists, that's obviously labels and industry and promoters and everyone as well. So the conversation has been very vocal in the last 12 months. And whenever you have artists coming forward talking about this issue, you always have critics on the other side, some of whom just like to make cynical, snarky remarks about pop stars. We might be in that group.
While you're correct, I don't want to be lumped in with that group.
Well, there's then a second group, which is there are the people who are just down on the climate emergency campaigners.
Yes, who that's the group I don't want to be part of, just to be absolutely clear.
Say that these people are exaggerating the issues, or they're being simplistic about the solutions of the issues. And of course, you know, in that group, there are people who outright deny the science that says that man-made climate change is reaching a really dangerous level. And those critics of celebrity climate change campaigners will quite often then immediately hone in on any air travel that yes. person has done recently.
And obviously, are you going to be walking between all your gigs, are you?
Because obviously, if you are a successful band or artist with a global audience, the minute you go on tour, I mean, conceivably, you could do Europe. I mean, I don't know whether taking a tour bus around Europe is that much more friendly. Depends what fuel the tour bus is using. If you were to do trains, I think generally speaking, again, if they're diesel trains, possibly not. But if they're electric trains, generally that's probably less of an impact. But it's
going to be a fairly small scale tour to be able to do that on a train.
Most artists, the minute they start touring around the world, they're going to start using lots of planes for them and their crew, etc. And so we have started to see an increasing number of people, often the climate change deniers, who their immediate hit back to pop stars who are talking about the climate emergency is, aha, you're a hypocrite, you're part of the problem because you're flying to all of these things. And I suppose before we get into what Coldplay have said, I mean, obviously, for most artists, you have to tour because that's how they make money. They couldn't be in business if they stopped touring. They may well be making decent money out of their recordings and out of their merch, etc. But touring is a key part of their business. So they can't just stop touring.
Yeah.
And so they have to carry on touring. And it was interesting at the annual general meeting of AIM, the Association of Independent Music, earlier this year, Peter Quick, who is the boss of Ninja Tune, also currently chair of AIM, used his annual speech to talk about all of this.
Yes.
So he said a few things about the music industry and the key things that AIM are currently campaigning on, but then he really honed in on the climate emergency. He's a very passionate supporter of the aforementioned Music Declares Emergency campaign. And he talked about various things that the music industry and labels and artists could be doing. It was actually really interesting that some of the ideas that he was putting forward. And if you go and check out the Music Declares Emergency website, there is actually a page on there with some really quite practical and in some cases quite simple things that music companies, and obviously within the AIM community, yes, you've got some big independents in there, but you've got plenty of really small businesses operating on incredibly tight budgets. And so, you know, even if you're really concerned about the climate emergency, if you don't have any money, then you are sometimes constrained about some of the stuff you can do. But both in Peter Quick's speech and on the Music Declares Emergency website, there are a bunch of things that you can do which are simple, cost effective, and can have a tangible impact. But he touched on the touring thing, on the flights thing, and was sort of saying, unfortunately, at the moment, this is something that we cannot avoid. And he was sort of saying how labels, who obviously are not actively involved in the touring usually with their artists, but that labels should come to the defence of their artists and have a ready-made defence when climate change deniers are hitting out at artists who are making a stand by simply honing in on the flight's point.
Yeah.
And I think there are various things that you could say in that scenario. So, I mean, one, which is just a pragmatic point, and the people on the other side would probably say, oh, well, that's a very poor excuse. But there is the element of saying, well, if you've got a really popular artist, if they were to only play gigs in their home country at venues that they could drive to or walk to or cycle to, then fans from all over the world would probably then fly to the UK to see them. And actually, having all the fans flying to the UK to see them, which would be much more damaging than having the artist flying to those fans' home country. So there is a sort of pragmatic balance there. But then there are other things that some artists have sort of come back with. There is the fact that, you know, you can do the climate offsetting thing, can't you?
Yes. And whether or not that's... I think the jury's out on whether that's a thing or not.
But certainly it's something that you could look into. And then, I mean, Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead, obviously another band who are massive vocal supporters of things like...
And recently donated money to the Extinction Rebellion.
And he was talking about this point in a recent interview, and he was sort of basically saying, OK, yes, it is an issue for the music industry, more on which in a moment. But the flip side is that when a climate change denier immediately hones in on that point, it's a classic distraction tactic, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it's sort of like, basically what you're saying is you have no solid arguments for the key issues that this artist is raising about climate change. So instead, you're distracting everybody
yes.
with this excuse.
Yes, because there's a much, much bigger picture of which artists flying around the world is quite a small part.
But
air travel obviously is a big part, and that's something, you know, clearly... Everyone needs to take fewer flights, but it's not the key contributor to climate change.
But nevertheless, what has been interesting to see in the last 12 months, as the climate change debate has sort of moved on to a whole new level, is this issue of artists having to fly around the world has started to be talked about in a way that I've never seen it talked about before.
Yeah.
And people are starting to say, OK, is there anything that we could be doing? And obviously the carbon offsetting thing, although, yes, maybe the jury's out on that, is something that people are talking about. But, I mean, I know you were talking about how the booking agent Emma Banks was on a recent podcast, I think, and she was talking about this.
Yeah, she was on BBC Introducing's Does My Music Suck podcast. Obviously, Emma Banks is a big booking agent, you know, who works with Katy Perry, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Muse, lots of big acts, so isn't in a good place to be commenting on this stuff. And she was saying that musicians have to be proactive on this and have to really consider how not to be part of the problem in the first place. I mean, she was suggesting kind of just making your stage sets less elaborate. She was saying, do you really need 27 changes of set during your show, all of which require lorries to drive around, moving them from place to place? If you have a more simple setup, then you're making less of an impact on the environment, even if you're still flying.
Yeah, so I suppose even if it's absolutely necessary that the human beings have to get in a plane, but by having less kit to move around, then you are reducing the carbon impact of the tour.
Yes, and I think it's, I mean, finally bringing us on to Coldplay. It's interesting that it was Emma Banks talking about who does work with these big artists, like Katy Perry has a big elaborate stage show. So, you know, she's not criticising someone off in the distance. It's people she's working with. And I think in this case, it is important that the artists at the top of the industry are the ones to start working to change things. And I think it's interesting and important that Coldplay are doing that, because Coldplay are a band who can afford not to tour for a couple of years. I mean, it's not the first time they've taken time off touring.
Yeah, it does sort of feel like that it is something where the biggest artists, like the artist Emma Banks work with, like Coldplay, should be taking a lead, partly because actually, I mean, they have the most environmentally unfriendly tours just because of the scale. I mean, even if they don't have that bigger stage set, they have many more people on tour with them, and every extra person is another flight, etc., etc. So they are having the biggest environmental impact to start with. But also, yeah, first of all, unlike a lot of the sort of middle-level artists, they can afford to take times off touring without that having a massive negative impact on their ability to operate as an artist. And also, where there are new ideas, new approaches, maybe new technologies that people are playing with, which we think might be able to reduce the environmental impact of shows, or maybe there are ways to more effectively offset the carbon footprint of a tour, all of these things. Obviously, artists that have more money, have more flexibility in their budget, can afford to experiment with these things, see if they are actually workable, and if they do genuinely make a tour more environmentally sustainable, and then if they do, share those learnings with the rest of the music industry.
Yes, so Chris Martin, speaking to the BBC in Jordan, everyone having flown out there. I know we're not doing that, but it did seem a little bit odd. Anyway, so Chris Martin told the BBC, "We're taking time to work out how can not only our tour be sustainable, but how can it be actively beneficial? How can we harness the resources that our tour creates and make it have a positive impact? Our dream is to have a show with no single-use plastic and have it largely solar-powered. I think it's a question of just accepting that you have to do your best, not be too overzealous in criticising others, because everyone will catch up if you prove that it's easy to do it the right way." And that's the point, that they have to experiment and prove that it can be done first.
He did, as part of that interview, also concede that the flights is probably the trickiest bit.
Yes.
To offset, even if you can make most of the rest of the production as sort of efficient and easily transportable, and as he alluded to there, you know, powered by solar energy or whatever. Yeah, you're probably still going to have to fly people around the world, and what can we do about that? But yeah, it was kind of interesting that he wasn't
teleportation.
Saying...
Chris Martin's going to invent teleportation.
Do you think that's the outcome of it?
I think that's it.
Do you think that's where Coldplay are currently putting their money?
I think it'll probably be one of those things, though. They'll get invented and everyone will be really excited, and then it'll turn out it's really damaging.
It will actually cause more problem.
Like CFCs. You know, CFCs were invented to be more environmentally friendly.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're not.
And the man who...
And there was a hole in the ozone layer.
The man who invented CFCs, this is a QI fact,
yeah,
I think,
isn't it?
Is also the guy who decided to put lead in petrol. That was a good move on his part. But I suppose the point is that what Chris Martin was saying, and in extent, which in some ways, although he can sometimes be irritating, was quite commendable.
I'm glad you thought, you know, could get a little dig in there.
What he was saying,
don't
want
to be pro Coldplay the whole way through.
We're aware this is an issue. We don't know what the solution is, but we're one of the biggest rock bands in the world, and we're going to investigate, we're going to research, we're going to talk, we're going to see what we can do to try and make touring more environmentally sustainable. And actually, as you said right at the outset, our ultimate ambition is to go even further than that, that our tours are not only not having a negative impact on the environment, is there any way they could have a positive impact on the environment? But we're not saying we have the solutions yet. This is a work in progress, and we're taking time out to do that work, and then we will report back, in essence, was what he was implying in this statement.
Yeah, he reckoned it would take a year or two to work all this out, which means no tour for the new album, Everyday Life, which is out now.
Maybe the solution, although no one in the live sector will like me for saying this, except maybe some of the venues. Obviously, we have talked about on set list before the hologram-esque shows,
yeah,
that are becoming more common, usually featuring dead rock stars and pop stars, recreated through video graphics, hologram style. And the technology is getting A, better, and B, cheaper. And so we have seen, I mean, there was a Buddy Holly one and a Frank Zappa one in the works, wasn't there? There was even talk of an Amy Winehouse one, I think. Now, it's very early days for that technology. But I think it will only improve. It will only get more cost efficient. And maybe that is ultimately the solution, that Coldplay don't go on tour, but a virtual Coldplay is playing in every venue in every city every night.
Yeah, well, VR as well. I mean, it could be, if you get a similar sized venue, you could have Coldplay playing in one venue, but they could be beamed to other stages around the world. I mean, it's not going to be the same, is it? Also, Grimes was saying in an interview last week that she didn't think live music was going to last. She thought it would be obsolete fairly soon because no one wants to go out and be in a real environment anymore. They want to be in something simulated.
And although
if you're just going out and seeing holograms staying on stage, that'll probably do it.
Although I think she was possibly exaggerating slightly in that interview. I do actually believe that the 2020s could well be the decade where the record industry is now fully back into growth, and that's only going to continue. And I think the live sector could be facing a tricky decade in the 2020s for various reasons, including challenges around environmental sustainability. But also, I think we may start to find that the TikTok generation is less excited about going into dark rooms and watching four people play instruments on a stage, and that maybe the live experience needs to change. That will probably involve some sort of technology. I have no idea what this is yet, but I can see this coming on the horizon. And of course, once more technology is involved in actually delivering the show, maybe the technology becomes the show, like we've just described. And although I think everybody of our generation would be like, oh, well, it will never be as good. You know, watching a VR hologram Chris Martin will never be as good
as the
real thing.
That's what old people always say, isn't
it? Exactly.
And they're wrong.
And they're normally wrong. So who knows? Maybe that is the future, even though there'll be plenty of people listening to this podcast right now who desperately hope that me and especially Grimes are wrong on that.
I think there's probably people shouting at us now, and that's because you're old and wrong.
Yeah.
And finally this week, Taylor Swift has had the all clear to perform at the American Music Awards. In fact, by the time you hear this, she will have performed at the American Music Awards and not be blocked like she was going to be. Oh, that Big Machine label, they were going to block her.
Unless she is blocked at the last minute, and that'll fuck up this podcast.
It really will. Let's record different intros.
So let's hope that doesn't happen. Yes, it does feel like that for the last 7 days, the CME Daily has basically been a daily update.
The Taylor Swift Daily.
On all things to do with Taylor Swift moaning. So I'm assuming that everyone listening to this podcast is possibly already bored of people talking about this, because boy, have everybody been talking about this. I mean, even American politicians have been getting involved.
And that's when you know it's boring.
Trying to turn it into a private equity story. So this all began...
as if it wasn't boring enough for it.
I mean
it's not boring. We're going to talk about it for 5 minutes now, and it'll be really interesting and exciting.
I mean, some people would say that there are some interesting questions about artist rights and draconian record contracts as part of this story.
Are those some people us?
Maybe that. Well, no, because I'm about to not say that.
Oh, right, okay.
And maybe there is. But, I mean, it's always important to remember, I mean, this is two sets of multimillionaires squabbling over how they share the next $1 million, isn't it? I mean,
well, yeah.
That is what this story is. So, as you all know, 10 days ago, as this podcast goes out, Taylor Swift took to the social medias, Tumblr, I think.
Which doesn't use this Tumblr anymore.
Which I think is how it ended up being a screen grab on the other social networks.
Right.
Will artists with important things to say stop posting them as screen grab JPEGs? Because for us journalists, it's a nightmare because we have to type them in.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
So stop doing that. But she did that. And basically she said, "Hey, Taylor Swift fans, I want to update you on the latest phase in her big beef with Big Machine, her former label." Now, yes, obviously, this is all part of a long-running story, because earlier this year, you remember this, Big Machine, owned by a guy called Scott Bachetta, he sold the company to another business owned by Scooter Braun, he of Justin Bieber, Ariana Grande management fame.
And that was Taylor Swift's worst-case scenario.
Because Big Machine still control all of the Taylor Swift master recordings except for the most recent album, which obviously she released with Universal Music.
Which has just been snubbed by the Grammys.
But that's not what we're here to talk about. No snubs in this story.
No.
Just moans and damning statements. So yes, she was unhappy that Big Machine and all of her master recordings, bar the most recent album, had been sold to Scooter Braun, who she accused of bullying her. And there had been some bad history because Scooter Braun was managing Kanye West. Obviously, there's history between Taylor and Kanye.
Yeah, everyone remembers that.
It was felt that Scooter then made that worse, blah, blah, blah. So there was history. She was angry about the acquisition of Big Machine by Scooter Braun. We knew that. There was lots of backwards and forwards between Taylor Swift's side and Big Machine's side about the ins and outs of that acquisition. And then this posting was basically saying, okay, latest development, guys, because, well, I suppose actually what I should be saying is between then and now, there was the whole re-record conversation.
Yes.
Because Kelly Clarkson, ever the meddler, went on the socials shortly after the original Taylor Swift being angry about the Big Machine acquisition thing and said, "Hey, Taylor, now that Big Machine control all of your master recordings, why don't you just re-record them? Do new versions and fuck them over by putting out brand new versions of your old albums." And obviously, I don't know if we talked about it on Setlist, because it possibly happened. Did we talk about it on Setlist? Anyway, definitely talked about it in CME Daily. Record contracts anticipate artists coming out a deal and then re-recording all of their albums to screw over the label. So record contracts deal with that, and we'll always have a re-record restriction. Well, not always. Every deal is different. But a classic record contract will have a re-record restriction, which will say to the artist, once this deal is done, once we're no longer actively working together, you're not allowed to re-record the songs that we have released for a period of time, set number of years. And so when Kelly Clarkson said you should just re-record, people like us said, well, probably there's a restriction in record contract for that. But then Taylor Swift subsequently said in an interview that actually, yes, there is a re-record restriction in her Big Machine contract, but because she worked with Big Machine for such a long time, the re-record restriction on her earliest albums, the country albums, is about to expire.
Yeah.
So that as of next year, she will be allowed to put out new versions of her old records, and crucially, she plans to do so.
Yes.
Now, actually, I think this is what we discussed on Setlist. I mean, the records that she will be re-recording are the records she made when she was really young.
Yeah, well, the question is she planning to record new versions or try to recreate the originals?
And my prediction would be either she tries to do a real faithful reconstruction of the original, in which case they'll be shit, or She'll just do completely radical new versions of her old songs, which may be brilliant, but won't really compete with the originals. They'll complement the originals.
Also, probably a lot of Taylor Swift fans only kind of listen to the pop Taylor Swift and maybe have never listened to those albums. So maybe it would bring those albums afresh to a new audience.
And then maybe some people will end up listening to the original versions and Big Machine will make some money.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I don't think that's her plan.
Latest development is that Taylor Swift alleged that Big Machine, since she went public with her plans to do these re-records, have been trying to pressure her to commit not to do that.
Yes.
And what she was saying in this message 10 days ago is, in essence, they were trying to blackmail me, is what Taylor Swift was saying. There's some projects ongoing at the moment which need Big Machine's approval.
Mm.
And basically, Big Machine is saying, unless you commit to not re-record these albums. And then she was also saying there was a stop dissing Scooter commitment as well. Unless you sign up to this, we will screw up these other projects for you. And the two projects that she mentioned in particular were a Netflix documentary and the aforementioned American Music Award.
Yes.
The former is more straightforward. Apparently Netflix are making a documentary about Taylor Swift. Needless to say, they want to put into that various tracks and videos that Taylor Swift released during the Big Machine years. And allegedly, Big Machine are refusing to license that content to Netflix. And Netflix are saying, well, without that, we can't put out this documentary. And conceivably, if Netflix wanted to, under US copyright law, they could try and say, well, it's fair use to use this music and we don't need a license. But it sounds like Netflix don't want to go that route, and I don't blame them. It's a really tricky route under American copyright law. So the Netflix thing is more straightforward. They want to sync some music, want to license some videos. Big Machine is saying no, and Taylor Swift's annoyed by that. The American Music Awards was more interesting because she was saying they're basically vetoing me from performing a hits medley.
Yes.
At this awards show.
Because, yeah, Big Machine can't stop her from just performing some of her songs live. The issue was that that award ceremony is being broadcast on TV, and by filming it and putting it out, you're making a recording of those songs, and it's the recording that has to be approved by the label. Although labels don't generally veto that sort of thing because it's not in their interest. It's sort of, no one really bothers with that stuff. Except in this case, because now there's bad blood. And so everyone is just needling each other. And so, according to Taylor Swift in this social media post, Big Machine was enacting that right to block her from performing and having her songs broadcast.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a technicality about record contracts. This is, I suppose, is the interesting possible artist rights element to this story. And it confused quite a lot of people, even in the music industry, because as you say, in terms of her singing her songs live, Big Machine can't stop her doing that because they don't have a stake in the copyright in the songs. And when she performs live, the recordings aren't being used. And even if they did have a stake in the songs, generally speaking, that's licensed through BMI or SCAP anyway. So you can't stop a live performance. But yes, a TV record technically is a record. It's a recording. And even without the re-record restrictions, it is true that under a classic record contract, because when you sign to a label as an artist, you are giving that label the exclusive right to record your performances until a certain number of tracks or albums have been delivered. This is why, if as a signed artist, you go on later on the BBC, technically the BBC needs to get a waiver from the label giving the BBC permission to record the performance, because the label has the exclusive right to record the artist's performances. But as you say, I mean, every label in the world's going to provide that waiver because everyone's desperate to get their artist on TV. And so what was basically being said here is the same principle applies to the re-record restriction in Taylor Swift's contract. Although it's interesting, when Big Machine subsequently put out a statement saying this is all sorted, Taylor can play the AMAs, what they said in their statement was, clearly the live performance, they have no control over that, we knew that. They were basically also saying, we don't think we have any control even over the initial broadcast of the programme, even though by broadcasting it, they are recording the performance. They were kind of saying it's all about the subsequent on-demand delivery of the content, because obviously the AMAs doesn't just get broadcast live. It also goes on various on-demand platforms. Maybe they put the medley on YouTube. And they were sort of saying it was the on-demand bit where they felt that their re-record restriction kicked in. So plenty of debate around what contractual rights Big Machine actually had and how they would be used. Because, although, as I say, these restrictions are pretty common in most record contracts. Incredibly rare for them. I mean, almost unheard of for them to be enforced in this way. They're only doing it in order to get leverage on the whole re-record dispute. But anyway, in addition to all of that, Big Machine were adamant that they hadn't made the threats that Taylor Swift was accusing them of, although they were a little bit non-committal in their denial of the threats.
Yes, Big Machine put out a statement saying, we have not done any of this. But then a spokesperson for Taylor Swift pointed out that they had put out this bold statement, but they hadn't specifically denied any of the claims that Taylor Swift had put against them.
Yeah, they said, we are not vetoing the AMA's performance or the Netflix documentary, and we don't even have the power to veto those things. And then what Taylor Swift's people were saying is, but they haven't specifically said that they weren't vetoing Taylor's right to perform songs that had previously been released by Big Machine and or for Netflix to include Big Machine tracks in their documentary. So while it might be true that they weren't specifically saying you can't perform at the AMAs, you can't have a Netflix documentary because they don't have the right to say those things, by exploiting some technicalities in the contract, they were in essence vetoing those things because they were making those things impossible.
Yes, but then obviously this became a very big news story that was reported everywhere and there was lots of discussion about it and what it meant or didn't mean. So then Big Machine put out another statement saying, we've sorted all this. We've done a deal with Dick Clark Productions, which puts on the American Music Awards. We've come to an agreement. It's all fine now. And that started another dispute.
Yes, because the initial wording of that second statement from Big Machine was basically saying, Big Machine and Dick Clark Productions, we've come together and we've sorted this out.
And then Dick Clark Productions came out and went, don't include us in this.
We're nothing to do with this. Don't be putting our name in this statement. So then Big Machine had to reissue that statement, sub-edited, so that it said, rather than Big Machine and Dick Clark Productions have sorted this out, in essence, the rework said, Big Machine has told Dick Clark Productions that this has been sorted out and it's all fine, is what the revised Big Machine statement was saying. But, I mean, it has to be said that there is still quite a lot of disagreement between Big Machine and Taylor Swift as to what was said behind the scenes and what was said officially. And then, I mean, Taylor Swift was then quoting emails that she claimed to have received from Big Machine and from Scott Baggetto, blah, blah, blah. So although the AMA's performance is going ahead, possibly the Netflix documentary will get produced, but there is still quite a lot of he said, she said going on regarding the ongoing dispute between Swift and her former label.
Yes. So in summary, by the time you hear this, Taylor Swift almost certainly performed at the American Music Awards playing a medley of her hits. We're recording this before that's happened, so we don't know that's what's definitely going to happen. It might be the case that she decides to use that as a protest and gets on stage and does nothing for 10 minutes. Maybe she'll play someone else's songs. You suggested in your report she could play a medley of Prince hits.
Yes.
Because he obviously had a history of fighting with labels, so that would be fun.
Or maybe she could get up and do a Kanye medley.
Yeah.
Bring it all round into a circle.
I think she's probably played a medley of her own hits and it all went to plan. But most likely, by the time you hear this, everything went ahead as planned.
Maybe they got Democrat presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren to present the award. She was one of the politicians to come out in Swift's defence because in Swift's little online moan, she had appealed to various people to come to her defence. So her fans, I mean, that Big Machine sort of said, that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do.
I thought that when I first read her statement, I was like, it's a bit, you're basically saying all of my fans, many millions of people should attack. Well, maybe she didn't use the word attack, but she was just like, you should get in touch with all these people from Big Machine and tell them to sort it out. So don't be telling your fans to do that.
I mean, all the people...
Anything could happen.
Yeah, and you know, those people are just doing their job.
Yeah.
And most of them not involved in Taylor Swift music at all. But as well as saying, hey fans, you should target Big Machine and Scooter Braun.
Not cool.
She was also saying that Scooter Braun's artist clients, Bieber and Grande, etc., they should be coming to her defence. Talk some sense to these guys, she was saying. I mean, the word on the grapevine is that throughout all of this, Scooter Braun has been telling everybody, this is nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
My company may have bought Big Machine. I am in no way involved in the running of that company. But she also took issue with a private equity company called the Carlyle Group, who have financed Scooter Braun's business, allowed him to buy Big Machine. And so she was saying that they too should have a word. And that was where the likes of Elizabeth Warren came in, because one of her things is that private equity is out of control and they're screwing up businesses. I mean, actually, in the music industry...
I mean, that's true.
It is true. But in the music industry, private equity have generally screwed up the corporate side of the business. They screwed up EMI. They screwed up iHeart, rather than screwing up individual artists. But she saw an opportunity there. Elizabeth Warren was saying, not only are they screwing up all these businesses across America, now they're screwing with Taylor Swift, and that's why you should...
That's a step too far.
...should vote for me next year. So maybe they had Elizabeth Warren to present the award to Taylor.
That's an interesting campaign thing, isn't it? To go like, a vote for me is a vote for Taylor Swift.
Well, these days in America, it probably
will. Maybe that's going to work, we'll
probably
see.
Shrewd campaigning on Warren's part.
Yes, so Taylor Swift to... Well, try. She did. She. There's another thing she said in recent times is that she was going to stop being apolitical, and now she's a campaign slogan. So lots of things changing, and lots of disputes to be had. Which I'm sure we'll come back to this, because I'm sure this is going to go on and on and on.
And being a weekly podcast,
yeah,
we'll be there whenever there's something else to say.
Exactly. But at this point in time, that is all we've got time for. So I'm going to wrap it up here. That's the end of this week's show. But if you have any questions or comments about anything we've discussed here, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. I've got a couple of recommendations.
Recommendations?
You know, I haven't done any recommendations of things for a while.
What are you recommending?
That's a nice thing to put in. Well, I wanted to recommend young Dan Lesac's podcast, Falling Forward, because it's really good.
Listen to it.
It's a show where he interviews not just musicians, lots of creative people about creativity and what drives them and how they go about their business and lots of things. It's really interesting. Lots of things come up in the discussions there that provide a lot of thought for time to come. That's certainly on some things. It's made me think differently about creativity and the business of creativity. And so that's very useful for me. Maybe it'll be useful for you too.
Well, I'll listen.
The other thing is going back to Netflix. Netflix have got a series called Explained. They explain different things. And there's an episode on music that is interesting because it's built around the producer Toki Monster, who had a rare brain condition. And then she had brain surgery to try to correct it. And she woke up from that unable to understand music. And although she regained the understanding, it kind of looks at the weirdness of, like, it's a very rare thing for someone who makes music and very much understands music to then suddenly not even understand it at all, like it's a foreign language. And how that affected her subsequent music making when she regained her comprehension. I knew she'd had some neurological problem with her music making, but actually finding out more about it was really interesting.
I could throw in a tip. I don't have a recommendation. I've got a tip.
That sort of sounds like a recommendation.
It's a bit of advice.
Okay.
If you go to supermarkets in Luxembourg,
oh God,
like I did last week, and you use the self-service tills, you're meant to take a ticket out of the self-service till and scan it in order to leave the supermarket. And if you just walk through the barriers, lots of people come towards you like you're a big thief. So there's a little practical piece
wow.
of advice.
Good advice
if you're shopping.
To everyone heading to Luxembourg.
Well, one person listening to the podcast might be going to a supermarket in Luxembourg.
They might be. Okay, so
they
take the ticket.
A whole different system. I can only assume that means that most people in Luxembourg are thieves and therefore they've had to put an extra layer of security in. At my local Sainsbury's, you just scan whatever it is you want to scan, bag the stuff you don't want to scan, and nobody cares.
Okay, so anyone listening in Luxembourg, do write in and let us know if you're a thief.
Yes.
But yeah, that now is it for this episode of Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
The weekly music yes. business podcast.
Which is presented by me. I am Andy Malt and Chris Cook.
Oh, you remember my name? Well done.
Yes, I remember
Even
your
though
name.
It wasn't written down, everything.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got this bit memorised. And it's produced by Matt Petey. I also remember that. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.